interview with Ali Amir on August 9th, 2006, when he started to describe
scapegoats.
Scapegoat is the way
you call
it?
Or Farewell Baghdad. No. Farewell Baghdad.
Okay.
Farewell Baghdad. Okay. The book is about the storyteller of the book is a youngster at the age of 16. Uh-huh. And he tells the last chapter of the Jews in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And telling us about his family, about his school, his friends, his Muslims, Jews. And other chapters are written by the writer, who is around 50. And you can see it immediately. When you read it, you can differentiate immediately when the writer is telling you the story and when the youngster, his name is Kavi. Kavi is the nickname of Jacob, Yaakov. And it's a book about the dreams of Jews and Muslims. The Zionist dream, the communist dream, the nationalism in Iraq at that time, the assimilators, young generation, young people, each and everyone has his own dream. And how all these dreams comes into a turning point in the history of Iraq, the 40s. The 40s, still Iraq is unrest. And Iraq is, there are many talented people there, and the state is not stable, the society is not stable, it's always under changes. And it will be like that. So during the 40s, these generations of new different youngsters, through stories, love stories, ballet dancers, national singer, the prime minister is here, all different tapes, the chief rabbis is here, every fact in history is accurate and exact.
So it's historical fiction.
Historical fiction. And
I just began only the first few pages, and I noticed that you start with the story of Sabah Adet.
Shafiq Adet, that's right. Yes.
Why did you start with that?
Because there were two events that changed the life of Jews in Iraq. It was a turning point for them. The first one was the Farhud, because before the Farhud, they did not realize that someday the mob will come just out of the blue and massacre and kill them. And there is a chapter about the Farhud in this book as well.
So it goes back in time.
Yeah. And the second event was the hanging Shafiq Adas. Shafiq Adas was an assimilated Jew. And he was not even Iraqi, he came from Syria. And his friends were the prince, the crown prince, Abdelilah, who represented, who acted as the king of Iraq at that time, because the king was young. The king was my age at that time, so he was
18 or something.
No. At that time he was 1948. Was 10 years old, 11 years old.
This is the young King Faisal,
the second. That's right, okay. 11 years old. So I see that you are familiar with the history. He was familiar with the prime minister, with ministers, with all the highest people. He used to host them at his home. And one day, somebody came by, I told the story that a journalist wanted I wanted to have money from them, from him. I forgot the word in English. It will come. Anyhow.
Okay.
To take, Rafael Kahat, Leschot Kesef, to squeeze him, to take money. That's, Leschot Kesef. So, and he was quite arrogant, this Shafiq Adas. He was very, very rich. Yeah. And he had all these big shots and big names and important people who were his friends. He's a big journalist who can threaten him.
Right.
And then after that, he published an article against him, accusing him that he sold ammunition to Israel. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. They hung the man. And
so the government
the crown prince, for a couple of days, could not sign the verdict because he knew the man.
Wow.
And he knew that he is innocent and patriotic, and he knew that all the story is a lie.
Right.
And then came to him the prime minister, and he said, "It's your head or him." Now, this was a turning point that if something can happen to Shafiq Adas, it would happen to every Jew.
Right.
So I brought this event at the beginning, first of all, because literally speaking, it's a nice story which attracts the reader immediately, that you have somebody who is hanged and another one who is searched at night by the police, the Iraqi police, and you get immediately to some...
like the depths of the
emotion. Yeah. And a little bit later, I mentioned Farhud from personal point of view, bringing there my personal memory when I was a child of 4 years old.
And you essentially put this boy in your shoes,
absolutely,
fictional character in your shoes. And what were some of those memories?
The memories here?
Yeah, the memories that you have personally that were...
Yeah. And you know, the first moment when you just told me, I didn't want to give you that interview.
Really?
Really. Because...
When I called.
I tell you why. It's not because of you. I feel what she's not to blame.
Yeah.
Because it's written here the best way possible.
Right.
The book gained here, and in Germany,
mm-hmm,
every compliment you can reach about.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
The story is amazing, and the hero is Baghdad as well, and Muslims, and all the troubles that you see, that every time the West and the Western people, like in this country as well, misunderstood the Arabs, the answer is here, and the answer is another novel that I published a year and a half ago. The name is Jasmine, which is the Palestinian and Israelis after the Six-Day War. So, in a way, I tried to put some my memories, of course, in a fiction way.
Yeah.
And I invent and build on a realistic way the novels I wrote, which all of them became bestsellers, and they are part of the curriculum, and very known in my country. So, and sometimes... I think, why the idiots, the English publishers don't publish it? It has such a wonderful potential, because it's Iraq as well, it's Baghdad as well.
Right.
And if you want to understand Muslims and Iraq, it's here.
Right. It's not only a story about Zionism.
No, not at all. The story ends like history was, that all the Jews came to Iraq.
Right.
But they came here to Israel.
Yeah.
And all their dreams here fall apart. So it's another tragedy. Zionists won because of bringing the Jews here. The Zionists failed the way they were observed here.
Right.
And probably you had stories from your husband, from your parents.
A little bit, from various interviews.
Yeah. So try.
I'm very interested in hearing about that integration process.
It won't be easy for you to read the book, but the effort is
worth it.
The effort is worth it, and if you can help somewhere in America to publish it.
Okay, I'll do my best. So, can we go back and talk about you personally, when you were born, and what neighborhood in Baghdad?
I was looking for CV. I have a very big CV.
Okay.
So if you have facts...
Yeah. I can give you a fax number. Here it is now. I'll give it to you at the end.
Would you like it in Hebrew? You know what? I have it in Hebrew, so I was born in Baghdad, and...
In what year were you born?
37. And...
what neighborhood in Baghdad?
I was born in Muslim neighborhood. which I write about it here. But during the 30s and the early 40s, the life between Muslims and Jews were good. So we're good neighbors. And I was breastfed by our neighbor, the Muslim, and her children were breastfed by my mother as well.
Why did they do it that way? Why weren't you breastfed?
They were young girls at the age of 20.
Uh-huh.
They had babies. They go to the market. They have to do things.
Right.
Where to put the child? So they put it to the neighbor. And if he cries, she breastfed him. Very simple. It's not that she gave her to her, but breastfed him. I don't have
milk. They're running to the market.
That, yes, good. The Yeri Bari Hamoud. Yes, Yofin and that. So that. Here we are. So, but in 43, when the war, second in that seat, Prime Minister in Iraq, Rashid Ali Gilani, he was pro-Nazi. And as a matter of fact, to be very objective and honest to them, they were anti-British because they wanted to free Iraq from the British regime.
Right.
Iraq was under British mandate. So,
do you have memories of Farhud? You're probably too small to have memories.
Were
you too small to have memories of Farhud? You were only 4 years old.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Wow.
But you know, this memories, it's a trauma. Traumatic memories, you remember.
Right,
when you are a child and you see from the roof Muslims, MAP coming, conquer your neighborhood, killing Jews, having parts of the hand of a child in their hand, running and yelling, burning houses. You remember that?
Yeah.
It's something that marked very deeply in your memories.
Was anybody in your family hurt or injured?
No, thank God. And you will be amazed. You know who protected us?
Mm-hmm.
The lady that breastfed me and my brother.
Really?
She came from her neighborhood. The moment she heard.
So she wasn't a neighbor?
At that time, not. We left the Muslim neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
To the Jewish neighborhood.
When she came to visit you. She came to you.
And then she heard that there is a massacre in the Jewish neighborhood. And and she knew, of course, where we lived because she was very close to my mother. They were like sisters. So she came there and stood in front of the door of our house, and it was seen that she is Muslim, and she said, "You will never touch these people. Jews are the neighbors of our of life. You will not touch them." And she stood there for 48 hours.
Oh, she stood guard.
Yeah, she guarded the family, and then she entered home.
She
was under shock.
Yeah,
because she was under shock too. There were good people, by the way, among them, of course, that saved lives.
Do you remember her name?
Her name is Khairiya, and I gave the name in the book. She is in the book. And this was my way to commemorate her. So we were saved by one of our family was hurt, was killed as a matter of fact.
A cousin, an uncle?
Of my father.
Yeah.
Of my father. So these two events, Shafiq Alas and Farhud, were, how do you say, landmark of this. And meanwhile, after the Farhud, the Zionist movement was established to defend Jews from another massacre. And of course, the establishment of Israel in 1948, which was the event of that period. So So there is a place of refuge. Well, there is where to go. That's what happened.
Right. So your family left in 51? You left?
50.
50.
Okay. My father was crazy to come here. He was Zionist.
Uh-huh.
He believed in the Zionist idea. And my uncle was an editor of a daily Jewish newspaper.
Named what? In Iraq.
In Iraq. Named Al Barid Al Yawmi. Dor Hayom. Which was a famous journalist in Poland and other places. There was a Jewish journal in Poland, Dor Hayom. The Post of the Day. The Post. And he was 26 years old, my uncle. And he was arrested. And he put into jail. And again, the story is here with changes,
right.
Many, many changes. But there is something realistic in it.
Right.
So the moment Jews could come here, my father registered. At the first day that they issued this law, of giving up your citizenship, my father was there.
Wow.
At midnight. At midnight was,
wow.
He took me with him. I was 11 years old.
Why was he so eager to do it right away?
Because he said, we have no future in this country.
Yeah.
That's finished. We have to go to our homeland.
What was his profession?
My father has a shop. He had a small factory. For rubber shoes, they imported rubber.
Mm-hmm.
This was an invention during the 40s. Rubber shoes.
Uh-huh.
So he started that. Yeah.
So, do you remember that day that you were standing in line with him in 1950?
Absolutely. It was here.
Yeah.
It's here. It was, of course, an extremely exciting days, and you could feel the days of Messiah, the days of redemption. There was something in the air among the Jews who were giving up their citizenship, their past 2,500 years of living in Iraq,
right.
And wanting to leave, which is not so easy. I mean, the fact itself, and endangering themselves by the fact that they're giving their identity card immediately,
mm-hmm.
and they remain citizens.
They don't have it.
Yeah, citizens without papers.
Until they go.
That you could, and it took a year sometimes. It took a year till they were able to go. So it was a very courageous and dangerous step to do. And of course, it's like cutting the, how do you say, when you have a baby and you
a cut. Cesarean?
Yeah, you cut him.
Oh, so cut the umbilical cord?
Yeah. There is no way back.
Right.
There is no way back. So here you cut all the ties with Iraq and you become a man with no, and of course they didn't know exactly what's going on in Israel.
Right. How did you feel coming? What were your emotions?
I think I was happy,
yeah.
Generally speaking, and I was under shock as well, because seeing all these events, they arrested my uncle, we gave up our citizenship, my father could not work anymore, the Jews were under certain kind of military rules,
right.
And the life became very dangerous.
Yeah.
The school was not as it was before,
right.
Because people left and there was an unrest, and we were quite afraid,
yeah.
At that period. And of course nobody knows what would be the future. What the future is having for us.
Yeah. Where did you go to school?
So I went to my school was the most modern school in Iraq at that time. The name of the school is Frankini.
Oh, Frankini, yeah.
Frankini. Frankini is a very big contributor who came later to America.
Yeah.
He was alive during the 70s in America.
Oh. And so Frankini was open in the 40s already.
That's right. I was there. I was the first group of students who came to, pupils who came to study at the school. It was the most modern one in every aspect of it, with the best teachers. The English teacher was a British lady.
Yeah.
The Arabic teacher was somebody from Saudi Arabia. They considered they were
the
best Arabic teachers, and it was a very high level school. I started. Yeah, but many years I did not use it in the country. I went to a kibbutz and this and that.
Yeah.
So I was, in a way, I was happy. It was a kind of an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I was quite concerned what the future is having for us.
Right.
Many things. Not
your parents were probably also worried.
My father was very happy. He had his own concerns. My mother rejected coming to Israel. She said that another time we knew that there is transition camps here and tents and unemployment and Fidayum, the Palestinians who attacked Israel. So we knew that it's not a country of milk and honey. So people were afraid, and most of the women didn't like to come because, you know, women must feed their children and take care of them. And we were already six children at that time and the family. Yeah. So, but she came.
What month did you leave?
We left. I think it was May or something like that.
May 1950.
Yeah, very early. Because we
were
one of the first ones who were registered.
Right.
So we were among the first group who left Iraq.
What do you have that remains there? Your house? Do you have other property?
We had house there and some the property of what all the machines that my father had. And we knew that it's gone.
Right.
Yeah. I think what is much more important are the memories that I try to put here, because when I wrote this book, I had a feeling that I am the sailor in Moby Dick. The eyewitness who will tell the last chapter, the last days of the Jews in Iraq. And this book, it was said here, at that time by the fifth president, Yitzhak Navon, read it and spoke for it in public, and he said, this is the last word about the Jews in Iraq, the last chapter. It never will be written any book of that level.
When was
it published? He said that in public. It was published in 1992. Mm-hmm. And it's a part of the curricula as well for highest levels.
Right.
And they teach it at the university as well.
And it is
the last chapter of the Jews there. This is the last page of the Jews there.
What happens at the end of the book?
The end of the book is very tragic in a way, because it tells the tragedy of the parents. How come? What happened to the father? And the boy himself became a street worker. Only later on in Jasmine, in my coming novel, it's a trilogy. This is the first one, Scapegoat, Tarnigol Kaparot, the other one. This was the first book that I published that made me a very famous writer overnight.
Right.
And it was a crazy vessel. They made film out of it. It was twice in theater, part of the curricula. Tarnigol Caparot. Tarnigol Caparot, you know the Tarnigol? So this, but the order is this one, the first Tarnigol Caparot is the second, Yasmin is the third. Yasmin, we will meet Kabi, the boy here that I invented, when he is 35. And we meet Nuri, the hero of Tarnigol Caparot, scapegoat, which is my alter ego. And his name is Nuri, who tells us the story in Yasmin when they are. He was, at that time, at the age of 30, advisor to the minister in charge for occupied territories. And he's the representative in East Jerusalem. So I tell the story of the Six-Day War and the two narratives, Palestinian vis-a-vis the Jewish one, the Israeli one. This one.
Iraq and their transition to Israel.
Absolutely.
And the story of Israel.
And
the story of the state of Israel.
You said that. Right. Very right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Is it your story in a lot of ways? Is it your own personal story in a lot of ways?
There are many autobiographical facts in the stories. But it is fiction after all because the combination of the story, or how you put the story, you know that. Mm-hmm. You probably know that as a journalist.
Yeah.
It is the fact that you called me and I received you and we are talking. I might use you. Mm-hmm. Your lovely face and mouth and teeth.
You could use me as a character in your next
book. As a character. And the way you sit here, you are not so free with me yet. Yeah, the way you ask for water, and this and that, and your name, I can use you in my novel. But you are, from the moment you enter that room, you became part of my autobiography. Because I am sharing with you personal stories, emotions, imagination. You don't know what I'm thinking, my imagination about you. And I don't know either what you think about me.
I'm just listening.
I'm not sure of that. You have another thought that comes. It's always like that.
Yeah.
About you, your family, maybe the father and the mother of your husband, he himself, whatever one. Everything that we hear takes us to different places, and we don't know at the moment. It comes later. And when you sit and write a story, I will see you. But I might write something entirely different. But it's based upon you. When you plant a tree, you put you put in the land
the seed.
The seed is yours. What kind of tree will come? We don't know. The tree is the fiction. You think that the writer is right. The seed is the facts of life. So the seeds are here. But what I did out of them, how I put them, and what combination, this is the story work, the writer's job. And many people, when they read it, they say, this is reality, that's what happened. The same way, you know.
Right. That's what people have said to you.
When I wrote the novel about the kibbutz, Tarnigol Caparot is about the kibbutz. So the kibbutz said, this is the story of the place. This is the smell of the place. Nobody even bothered himself that I invented the story, which is based upon the seeds of the place and me and others. But the story is a fiction. So this is the way it should be.
Can I use the bathroom and come back quickly?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You go.
Where do I go? Out to the right, or I think I thought when I came in.
No. זה מהפיקוח, חטאתך לענות. אנחנו מקווים שהמצב נרגע קצת, זה חדר הפיקוח. מה? טוב, העיתונאי בינתיים יצא לעשות ביבי, אז אני מנצל את זה שהיא הלכה לביבי. טוב, מה עם הארונות? הגיעו? I think mainly that would sound very I had a feeling, a very, very strong one, that since I was a child there, that I am witnessing a chapter of a history, the last page of the history. I was a very, and I'm still, a very sensitive child, till now. I'm still a child, very, very sensitive. And I felt at that time that I'm witnessing a unique chapter in the history of my family and the Jews of Iraq. Now, the Jews of Iraq, all of them were only 1,300, so it's a big tribe. It's a big tribe. 130,000 people. It's
tiny.
Yeah. And big families with the branches. If you take the Jews of Iraq, especially in Baghdad, as a unit, Basra, another unit, Mosul, the third one, the Kurdish group, you will find big tribes with marriages here and there. And if I will investigate where this Murad came from, believe me, after maybe 15 minutes I will find that we are some relatives here and there, you see. So you see, when I speak about family, I speak of our larger family or something like that. I'm very sorry that I'm quite tired now, but I will be energetic maybe later, but this time usually I take a nap. I live in Jerusalem, so. Anyhow. So, and when I came to this country, I found out, of course, immediately, like all my generation, that those who observed us, those who took care of us, knew nothing about us. And they considered us as Arabs. Arabs.
You felt that when you came?
Immediately.
Yeah.
The status of Arabic language was very low. It was, you have to remember that at that time the Arabs were enemies. Everything that belonged to them belonged to an enemy, defeated enemy, second, third, fourth class citizens in the culture. Not enemy that you look up to or admire or appreciate. They were nothing, zero, primitive, defeated. Their language was a stagnatic one, not developed. Their music was yelling for something, blah 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 blah, monotonic one for hours. They have no modern literature. They have nothing. They are under British or French. They are even not independent enough to take care of themselves. And they are primitive. The modern technology is not there of that time. So a Jew who came from such country immediately considered one of them.
This,
absolutely. The same way with you. You come from America. America, America. Wherever you go, America! You might be stupid,
right.
Primitive, zero, poor, nothing. America!
Right.
America. America, America.
It's on labels.
That's right.
Right.
So, that's what I felt. Now, I myself was, grew up as a prince
yeah.
in my family.
Uh-huh. Were you the oldest?
Yes, I was. I came from good family, talented family. I was raised as a prince. I was an excellent pupil. I was, at that time, I even wrote to the journal of the school. And all of a sudden, I came here and I was like dust.
Nobody knew your family?
Nothing at all. And my father lost everything.
Were you in Navarra?
Of course.
How long?
7 years.
7 years.
Yeah. So, every, and then we lived in a slums area, in Jerusalem, in Katamon.
Oh,
it is a slums area.
Was there a Mabara in Katamon?
No. Mabara was in Pardes Hana, it's near Hedera.
Yeah.
And then it was another one. Yeah. You see one, you see them all. You hear of one, you hear of all. So, when you come, and then when I came to the university, I felt again, although I studied at night, I finished my matriculation at night.
Yeah.
And at the boy, during the days, I started to work as messenger boy to make my living alone as a child in Israel, in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
My family was still in the Mabara. I came to Jerusalem to pave their way to come to Jerusalem. And
what were the Mabaras like?
You would hear that from everybody.
I want to hear it in your words. Could you describe, you articulate it better than most people can?
I think that the Mabaras were, it's not even a military camp. It was poor camps. It was camps of tents, neglected, not organized,
yeah.
Tent and dust, what and what it symbolizes.
Mm-hmm.
And the people walk there and behave there like shadows. They were shadows of themselves. They lost everything they have, their name, their money, their status. Their clothes were ridiculous. I mean, the suits that we came, which was the most modern suits in England at that time, because Iraq was under a British mandate.
Yeah.
And Jews, their second cultural language was English.
Right.
And they used to have the English tea with milk afternoon. And they studied there, and they spoke English and French, because they learned in Alliance as well, the children.
Right.
So they came here.
And
they became, while the khaki at that time was the official suits of the elite. At that time. And whatever we had, a tie was something that you should be ashamed of.
In Israel.
So in Israel, everything you came with was here nothing, zero. So, you started your names, the names.
Okay.
My name is Khlasti. This is the name in Iraq. Everybody, most of the Iraqis knows about my family name.
Yeah.
Khlasti. It is written here. I dedicated the book to my father and I put his name. Father, mother, and my uncle.
Yeah.
They pronounced this name here in 11th version. And they wrote it in 11th version. Because Ashkenazim, 11th version. Because Ashkenazim are they cannot, they didn't bother, they didn't want to spell it as it should be.
Yeah.
And everybody wrote it, every clerk or every office wrote it, the way he heard it, and that's all. He did not pay attention to you.
Right.
I was almost put into prison when I was a soldier, when my commander made laugh of my name.
Wow.
And I rebelled. I said,
what did he say about your name? How do you spell this? What is this?
He changed the name. And he started to laugh at the name. He said, what is this name? And he made some improvisation, mocking on my name. So what left for you? Now, my name is Fuad. Fuad is an Arabic name.
Right.
Eli comes from Elias. I had a second name. I was Fuad Elias. So whatever you had, and I describe that in the novels, and every asset you have became here at dust.
Right. How did you choose your last name? How did you choose Amir?
In the kibbutz, I was sent through Youth Aliyah to a kibbutz. Now every group in the kibbutz, every group of children in dormitories, they have their own name. So the time came that our group, the Iraqi group, after a month, they have to give us a name. They couldn't name. So it was a competition between the children who will bring a name for the group. So they brought 20 names. And I came with Amir. Amir behind is a bunch of wheat that put together. And this was the idea of the kibbutz, that you take individuals and put them together, and it's wheat. But more important than that was the initials of the name. Amir. Ayin is Iraqi.
Yeah.
We came from Iraq.
Yeah.
Mem Menachem was the teacher. Yocheved was the, how do you say it, the housekeeper of the group. And Rivka was the counselor of the group. So these three people worked for us. And it's the.
It's a wonderful way to put together names.
And then our name is Amir.
Right.
So all of a sudden my name got.
Did you want to change it from Karachi?
No, I did not change it at that time. This was the name of the group of the 40 kids from Iraq who were educated with me for 3 years in the kibbutz.
I
left the kibbutz in 1954. Absolutely. And I carried the name till 1960. In 1960, I finished the army. With all the troubles I have with my name in every place. And I came to the Hebrew University. And I didn't want to start the same tragic thing at the university. And I was a young man, I wanted to date with girls. I didn't want to start with them in such a low level that I have to
explain
my name and spell it 10 times and sound to them like rock in the air. Chlashchi. Who can say that? They're calm. So I said to myself that I will adopt the name I gave myself to my group in the kibbutz.
Yeah.
And actually my brothers and sisters followed me. Mm-hmm. My father not.
No.
They remain with their name.
David,
of course.
David,
Morris, and Ephraim.
Yeah.
Do you know them?
I interviewed David, and he said that for great Iraqi food.
So David and my father are cousins, are Bnei Dodim.
Yeah.
So here
cousins.
And you know them?
Yeah. Oh, it's
so you see?
Guy.
So you see? I told you that the Iraqis, if you just.
Right. All you have to do is go.
Yeah.
Generation or
I met with David Morris and Ephraim, I think 4, 5, 6 months ago. I was in London.
Uh-huh.
I was giving lectures there, and they came to listen to my chat lectures, and for a very big reception I was giving.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So that I know.
Right.
So now you know that I am not telling you stories.
Right. So. Not in agriculture?
Their branch comes from agriculture,
right.
So you know that.
Right.
We are the second branch who started. Our branch was responsible for the tomb of Yechezkel HaNavi. And in a certain time, my grandfather decided to come to Baghdad because his children wanted to got a higher education at the universities. So they came to Baghdad. They made some detour. They first went to Kirkuk, the oil city, to work there. They separated. But David Ephraim and Morris remained in their village as agriculture, and they invented, they brought, as a matter of fact, at the 20s, the modern agricultural equipment to Iraq, combines tractors and things like that.
Wow. Yeah. And then he ran a car company, I think.
Yes, and the car company, and they developed themselves, and they came, of course, to England later. They did not leave Iraq in 1950. They left, I think, in
1967,
before the war. His brother left even, Morris left even later. And David, the other David, left, I think, at the mid...
73.
Later than that. A beautiful wife. You met him?
I met him. I interviewed his wife.
With green eyes, David.
Yeah.
A lovely person.
Yeah.
Very arrogant.
Oh, yeah.
He left at the mid-80s. I met with him, too. I think so. Yeah.
With white hair?
Yeah.
Okay.
I met him in 1992. This book, by the way, there are some of the stories here about them. And it's based about this, upon stories that Morris, one of the brothers, told me about the family.
Really,
agriculture, their branch, in a way. I made some illustration about the stories.
So when you said that your family was in charge of the
they were in charge for
the tomb.
An uncle, the brother of my grandfather, Abraham is name, that David Morris and the other, no, because he was married to their uncle, one of their uncles. He was in charge of the tomb of Yechezkel
HaNavi. What does that mean to be in charge
of it? Keeping it clean? He was the chief in charge on this area. It was a big area.
Oh, the whole area.
The two Jews came from all over Iraq in Chag Shavuot. They come and they stay overnight there, and it was a big ceremony. They prayed. It was a holy place, and it was a chan. It was a very big place that hundreds of people came and stayed overnight. Wow. It was kind of industry.
So he was the custodian.
That's right.
Interesting. You probably went there as a child, too.
Yeah.
What was it like? What is it like there?
A tomb, big one.
Yeah.
People came there with a feeling that they are coming to a holy place.
Yeah.
They ask for good wife and good husband and success in exams and having fortune or each one came with his wish, and to pray for health, all kinds of things that people need in their lives, and they used to stay overnight in certain cases, and they have candles and they pray.
In Israel, you've been very involved in all sorts of things related to Aliyah and Kita. Why? Why has that been important to you? Because of your own experience?
I started my career as I told you, as a messenger boy at the Prime Minister's office. And my dream at that time was to be advisor to the Prime Minister on Arab Affairs, which I become.
Right.
And then I found myself in 1968, 67, some of these experiences are in Jasmine, my last novel, Jasmine. That it's not only that I'm not going to bring peace to this country, this was my dream, like many other stupid people here from the Eastern countries, Arabic-speaking people who thought that we were given the opportunity to make peace with Arabs. We had no influence, we had zero influence at that time and even later. And nobody even listened to what we have to say, till now, generally speaking, till now. They listen to us now, because we became important people, celebrities, some of us.
Right.
But nobody is implementing. Do you know what I wrote today to Olmert? Mm-hmm. I wrote him that we neglected, I was on TV last day, last Friday. And I have a permanent radio program, a weekly one. So I spoke there that we neglected the information and psychological combat or fight against the Arabs. Nasrallah is fighting us psychologically, fighting us. And we give him plenty of time when he speaks.
On the airwaves, on the air.
Israel has now Al Jazeera of its own. They have no radio station. There is something for entertainment. To explain her what Israel stands for, why we started the war,
right.
Why are we killing so many people in Lebanon?
So the
for what? There is no Hezbollah. No, we neglected that. No wonder the Arab countries and the world is. There are many reasons. This is one of them.
Right.
They are backing Nasrallah and others. Because Israel does not exist there.
Israel doesn't exist
in Hezbollah.
Right.
Now, Hezbollah, you have to speak to the people every day. Mm-hmm. And we are not doing that to the Arab world or to the Lebanese. And it's something, where it's a crime that we committed for us. We are harming us. It's out of arrogance. That we are part of the West, so these people, in any case, know only the language of force.
Right.
So why should we explain to them? Which is, of course, stupid.
So what can we do for Hezbollah?
So I wrote him today that it is crucial, I know him, to establish here Al Jazeera of our own to explain to the Arab world what we are doing every day and why in Arabic. Yeah. Not only because of the war. But everything that we are standing for, we are giving them a stage. We don't have a stage there. People here admire Nasrallah, something stupid. He wants to finish with Israel. I say that we trust him, he's a man of his word, he's a charismatic leader, we don't have leaders like him. Damn it, what is this?
Won't Arabs just see the station, no matter what it is, as a propaganda arm of the Israeli government?
All right. But they, as long as you listen, at least you can speak up.
Yeah.
And at a certain point in the history, up to the 70s, it's beside the point of the interview. The Arab world were listening to the broadcasting services in Arabic and Israel. Every word there was holy.
Right.
They knew that if they want to listen to the truth in their own countries, they have to listen to the Israeli broadcasting services in Arabic. We can do that the same here.
Yeah. Did you volunteer to head that type of Israel Al Jazeera?
They will not ask me, but if they ask me, I will help, of course. So, let me finish that with why I was involved in adoption. So in a certain point, first of all, I gave up the hope that I would bring peace. The other thing I found out around me, that Iraqis, good people, successful people, talented people, are geared or channeled to two occupations, generally speaking. One is working with Arabs, with all being teachers, translators, in the Shin Bet, in the Mossad, with Arabs. And the second one is to be counted numbers,
yeah.
Banks. And they succeeded in both. Very, these two spectrum of occupations. So I said to myself, I will not become an Israeli as long as I will be part of this, which became at that time even traditional occupations of Iraq jobs. So all my life I rebelled in a nice way, in a gentle way. I did not kill anybody. But I rebelled in my own nice way. So I said to myself, I want to belong. How can I belong? I can belong if I will be a general, chief of the staff, the army. Here, it's sacred. Or absorption and aliyah. It's the two aims of the country, to bring here Jews, absorb them properly, and to live in the country. So at that time, when I got to this conclusion, I was 28, quite late to be the chief of the staff, to start again. So I made shift of 360 degrees to work at the absorption business, to belong to the something which is fundamental for the country. What?
Were you primarily responsible for Mizrahi Jews?
No. This was the reason why I rebelled. And when I started to work in absorption, I was responsible for everything. And I became deputy director general, acting director general, because I made my work on my life proper way. Mm-hmm. And later on, I became director general of Youth Aliyah in the Jewish Agency, which is the first Oriental Jew to become
really?
A director general of being in charge of all the youngsters who are coming to the country. Okay. Russians, Ethiopians, and others.
How has Aliyah improved over the years since you became...
It improves in a lot of things, and they corrected many of the mistakes that we suffered from. And assisting to newcomers now are enormous and wonderful, but something fundamental remain terrible is the cultural absorption of all the newcomers who come here and how to give them feeling of belonging. I mean, if you absorb somebody, he has to feel that he belongs. This is the most important thing, and that he's not an outsider.
How do you achieve something like that?
Very complicated. You are not interviewing about absorption business.
Right. Well, that's part of your story. It's interesting to me.
First of all, to master the language.
Yeah.
To master the language. Right. To make enormous efforts to get to understand the culture of the place. The way of doing the things in this place, the mentality of the people, the spirit of the country, the spirit of the people, what is in common there? What is the water which goes beyond this, beyond the hadama, haritzpa, the floor? Yeah, there is beneath us a water. זה נקרא מי התהום, המים שלמטה. מי התהום, what is מי התהום שלך? It means, where are your deep, deep roots that even you don't know of, but they influence their life. They make you as you are. So I try to find this water beneath that make Israel as it is. And this is maybe the second thing that I do in my life, which is of great importance, being a writer.
Right.
So it's the same, is not only to master the language and to belong, is, but more than that, to express others,
right.
To express the countries. And when Tanigal Kaparov, my first book, became overnight part of the curricula and part of Bagrut, of matriculation here. Chaim Guri, the very famous poet, said, Eli Agnon would say that you entered Sidurat Filah. Now, I said, what that means? He said, they are teaching your book at school, so you become like Sidur Tfilah. And this is a great compliment, because here you have a newcomer who made it, and his books are being taught here. So
yeah,
that's right. Yesterday, I called the general who I wanted to speak with one of our generals, whom I met in a meeting a year ago. So his secretary is at the age of 20. When she heard my name and she listened to what I want, he was not there. She said, excuse me if I ask you, are you Eli Amir the writer? I said, yes. She said, you wrote Tanigal Kaparov? I said, yes. She said, she started to yell, she and her friends around. She said, we studied you at the school, so it's you.
Right.
So I said, well, now after you recognize me, see to it that your general will call me back.
Right.
And of course, he took care of that.
Right.
So when you reach that point, this is another thing. It doesn't mean that you will feel that you belong,
right,
but you did another step.
Right.
So this was the reason why I started with. I changed my job as expert in Arabs and things like that.
Right. How long did it take you? I mean, it's hard to pinpoint the time, but it's an amazing thing for an Olah Hadash back in the 50s or whenever, an immigrant, to start studying Hebrew and to become not just a master of the language, but become a storyteller, a famous storyteller. How did you make that transition?
First of all, I'm still learning. I'm still...
I don't believe it.
Okay. I'm still struggling with the language. I can show you drafts of the new novel that I'm writing right now. It's always... But it's not only me. All the writers are correcting and correcting. It takes a long time. It's an ordeal, and it's a long way. You have to be persistent,
mm-hmm.
You have to be stubborn, you have to pinpoint the targets,
yeah.
And you must see it always and strive to get to it, to find it. To catch the spirit, you need something that not everyone has. You may master the language, but of course it's not enough to become.
Did you ever translate? Did you at the beginning write in Arabic and translate?
No.
You always started writing right away in Hebrew.
Right.
That's the way to do it, I guess.
Yeah. Huh. And the first day I came here, I mean, you were here 4 years.
Yeah.
After 4 years, I spoke. Excellent Hebrew. I think after 8 months, I started to write novels. After 8 months, I started to read even less than that.
Mm-hmm.
Every novel I found.
Right.
When I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. The first day I arrived, I started to learn. It sounds for you an arrogant, but it's not arrogancy, it's good senses of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And my father felt the same. So it's a sense of a child that he wants to belong.
Right.
So when I saw Sabra boys and girls, and they spoke Hebrew with their beautiful native accent.
Mm-hmm.
I want to be like them.
Right.
So if I come to America, you know what this guy from the archive told me when I showed you where the toilet?
Right.
He said, Really? Oh, you speak beautiful English. It's excellent style. How do you say? Not style. Accent.
Yeah.
You thought that I'm speaking. You know that I'm not speaking American accent. Yeah.
But you thought you were.
I thought for him, you know, because. See what I. But it's not enough to master the language.
How did you get a hold of books and newspapers? Did you read newspapers too, or?
I started with pieces of a newspaper because we didn't have money to buy a newspaper. So I used to go to Hedera or Partizana, the vetters, and to look at the garbage where there is a newspaper or something like that. Wow. So I took it and I came to the tent
and read. Then how did you begin getting books?
When I was in the kibbutz, I was sent to a kibbutz eight months later, 7 months later. And the first thing that I asked for is, where's the library?
Right.
Because I came from a very, I told you.
So you were actually 7 years school. In Mavara? No, 7 months?
No. The family was 7 years in Mavara.
Okay.
From 50 to 57. I was 7 months at the beginning. Then I was sent to the kibbutz for 3 years, and then I returned back to the Mavara.
Ah.
Yeah. 7 years, the family was.
Right. The transition of coming back must have also been jarring and traumatic.
Absolutely. Very. Everything, my life is, nothing is my generation as well. Our life is pieces of transitions. From one point to the other, and still there is no end to it. I mean, for others, I consider my country, I'm not arrogant, because I want you to understand what I'm trying to tell you. I'm a celebrity in my country. If you ask in the street 10 people who is Eli Amir, probably one of them will know.
Probably nine of them will know.
All right. Okay. So. No, really, I'm quite often on TV. I have every week a radio program. My books are taught. I reach a very high position in the country when I work in the government. And this, I was asked quite frequently to say what I think about the situation. I know the ministers. I can communicate with them. For sure, Wilmer will refer to my letter. So for the others, I'm celebrity, I'm the center of the country.
Right.
I feel still that I am not 100% of this country, or not 100% belonging to this country.
Because you came from Iraq, because you came from somewhere else.
Yeah. Not only from Iraq, I will jump to another step. The fact that you were not born here, it's like in America. See, if you were not born, there is a difference between the first generation of Jews who came,
right,
the second and the third. Second generation is American, third generation, absolutely American. Because they were even born to a father who was
right.
Born in America. So it is a long process, and especially if you begin from less than square one, as we started. You're climbing up in the society. It's terribly difficult, but I want to tell you, and it is very important that it will become from my interview as well.
Mm-hmm.
The story of the Iraqi Jews is a story of success.
Mm-hmm.
Not only them, but most of the newcomers who came to this country from East countries, Muslim countries, and East European countries. The story of the mass immigration of the early 50s, which built that country, is a very, very successful story. Iraqi Jews, because you are writing about them, they reach every position they want.
Mm-hmm.
They are not prime ministers yet. The chief of the staff, the current one, his father is Iraqi.
Yeah.
The chief of the staff, Moshe Levy, in 1992-90 was Iraqi.
Yeah,
many generals are Iraqis. Mm-hmm. Professors at universities, three prominent writers, mm-hmm. poets, others, philosophers. It is a businessman,
right.
affluent people. Shlomo Eliyahu, this place that I'm here,
yeah.
all this building belongs to him. Insurance. He started as a messenger boy.
Right.
If you come 2 hours earlier, you would see him come to visit me. Every time he knows that I'm here, he comes to visit me. So people, it is a very successful story in all aspects of it. It took a long time. There is no miracles. We started, all of us, from less than square one.
Right.
But
it
is, made
it. Not such a long time. I mean, in relative terms,
that's
only,
right.
really only two decades, maybe.
That's right.
Right. By the end of the 70s.
By the end of 70s, we started to...
They really integrate and move up.
To climb up, not to integrate. It's mm-hmm. here, the wasp. The Israeli wasp, like the wasp in America,
mm-hmm.
they will not let you come in.
Mm-hmm.
They preserve their
cocoon.
The farm.
Right.
If they are a farm,
right.
there is another word in English. Which ends with ange. Ranch, no.
They preserve their domain, the place that
they preserve their domain,
right.
and they won't let others enter because it's competition, it's terrible competition.
Right.
And they want to remain the West, the closed circle,
mm-hmm.
that it is almost impossible to penetrate.
Mm-hmm.
But from time to time, you can. Somebody
right.
can. And even if he comes already and he's there, but for them, he's still an outsider, and he feels that.
Mm-hmm.
From time to time, they volunteer, so to speak, to tell him something that he doesn't know.
Right.
That he was not here when
right.
it happened.
Right.
Or they have their own tricks. If I want to make you feel
like
inferior or outsider,
yeah.
I can do that 10 times, 20 times, in a very gentle way.
Right.
Then you walk out and say, oh my
right.
God, I felt so bad with this
they
guy.
Don't belong in this country.
Yeah, I don't belong. So it is an ordeal, and it's not, I'm not complaining, I'm trying to portray
mm-hmm. the story of
of being outsider who wants to become insider. The integration, the full integration, the cultural integration, the mentality integration.
Mm-hmm. I have another question for you. Would you agree with the statement that this book and you, your personality in general, appearing on TV and radio and so on, and capturing the story, telling the story of the Iraqi Jews, that's not the only thing that you did, but that's one of the things, do you agree with the statement that your work has made the story known, made the story of the Iraqi
absolutely.
Known?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
For years it was really hidden.
Where more than that, I think that not only me, but you are talking about myself, I think that the writers, the poets, the speakers of Iraqi Jews, especially us, the writers, I think they push ahead the Iraqis and they made them become known and even close to Israelis. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Iraqi Jews doesn't mean anything for you. It's one of 100 diasporas here.
Mm-hmm.
If you read Scapegoat or if you read Mafreha and even Hebrew,
mm-hmm.
you will spend with me a week or two in your most intimate hours. You and me alone.
Mm-hmm.
Your husband cannot take care of that because you are reading. He cannot make love to you. You are reading. You are busy with it. and you want to understand the characters, you listen to my voice, you see the pictures I draw to you, by the end of the book, I will become part of your life. If the book is good, you will like me. You will like me. People, I can see that. People like me automatically wherever I go.
Because they love your characters and they love your stories.
They have the stories. They love the character. They have the way I speak. So my wife always telling me, Eli, you know, when I say that my name is Dili Amir, the first question is, have you any relationship to the writer? When
right.
I said that you are, that I am your wife, all the doors are open to me.
Right.
And my children in the army, at the university, they say, Daddy, you don't know what your name is. How known are you? So what does it mean? It means that if you want to become known and familiar in a society of immigrants, literature, poetry, music, these are the three things, major ones. They pave the way for you. They make you intimate, close, familiar. They will stop afraid from you. We are afraid always from the outsider, from the stranger, from the other. The other is different. You speak English, you eat this junk food of yours in America, Big Mac, Big Schmack. What's Big Mac? With cheese and meat. What? How can you? You speak another language, your humor is different. All your behavior is different.
Through literature and art,
I absorb you.
You can do things that businessmen and lawyers and
absolutely.
Doctors can't.
I absorb you. I can feel you. You become intimate and very close to me. This is the way we got to know Polish Jews, Russian Jews, through literature. I know them, I know about them, I love Yiddish, I wish I know Yiddish. From where? Through the literature, through poetry. So it works on both sides. I expose myself to others through my literature. You know, Shimon Peres said once in public, he said after he read this book, he said, Eli, how my grandson would like to become Iraqi. And he always said that. He himself.
He almost said it.
Shimon. Or he himself. Why? Because, my God, these people that we look at them from up down, what a story is Eli telling us. Who were they? Now we know them. In life, if you sit with me, how much can you sit with me? An hour or two?
Right.
And I'm tired from this man. Let me go.
Right.
Let me go. A good book, you remain with him, and you remember him. And if you want to read another thing again, you take the book and you reread it.
Right.
That's
now
the important.
The question is, you've done that. You succeeded in Israel in doing that. But, as you were saying at the beginning of the conversation, published in America, the story of the Iraqi Jews is not, or of the Iraqi Jews in general, is not understood in the United States and in the West, obviously as well as the European Jews, because the Shoah has, the Holocaust has obscured that story. So, it's not a question, it's more of a statement. It seems very important that this work and these kind of works are
I think it's very important. First of all, it's a book about Iraq, about Baghdad.
Right.
Americans should understand Iraq, and it's here.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the main purpose of coming to America 30 years ago to be the executive director of American Israeli Federation is to get these people to be known in America as well,
right.
And to be their voice. This was, you know, we had this, unfortunately, job to put ourselves on the map of Jewish people.
Did you succeed?
Partially. Partially. I think our main contribution to this country, I am talking now as a writer, or if you want to take the contribution of Iraqi Jews, the contribution is in every aspect of life of this country. Economy, academy, media, we have excellent journalists, sport, we have excellent basketball and football players. But I think that I'm very proud that we brought to the Israeli literature the new characters of Jewish people. One, the culture of Arabs and the culture of Jews who lived with the Arabs. The songs, the music of the language. Because if you read my books, if you are sensitive enough and master Hebrew enough, it's a different music. It's the music of East and West, its combination. Mm-hmm. We brought metaphors and idioms that comes from the Muslim world, the Eastern world. We made Arabs, Palestinians, Muslims more familiar with all the rejection that Israelis and East European and American had to this type of people. They reject Arabs, they hate fundamentalists, they hate Islam. They are very afraid of Islam. He is the other for them. He's not known, not understood. You can understand him through literature. So it's a great contribution that we did not get yet. The real recognition for it. We deserve more recognition that we do have with all what we have. And there aren't so many writers whom their books became part of. Yeah. But even though there is not yet enough recognition of this contribution to the Israeli society and to Israeli culture. Before the writers, and there are a handful of Arab countries, this area was vacant, neglected. And besides that, we brought to the Israelis and to other Jews in the world, if we are translated to, the character, the mentality, the portrait of a Jew from Eastern country, from Iraq, Egypt, Syria.
In a way, I haven't read all of this book yet, but in a way, this kind of Jewish character who associates with Muslims, who's friendly with Muslims, who works with Muslims side by side, is probably the kind of Jew that a lot of peace-loving Israelis would like to be. We'd like, ideally, to live side by side in peace and harmony, not that everything was harmonious.
Yeah.
That's
right.
So, is it a kind of yearning? Do people say they read that and they see that character and they want it to be like that for Jews in Israel?
I will tell you a short story. I was invited to Egypt many times, the last time. When Yasmin, my last novel, which is the story of Palestinians and Israelis, during the Six-Day War and after that, mainly after that, with this love story between Jasmine, the Palestinian, and Nuri, the Iraqi Israeli. October, the most popular weekly magazine there, translated 4 chapters of the book, and he published every week 1 chapter with my pictures, with the pictures of the book and this, in a very lovely, complimenting way. Now, I was invited to Egypt and I was given a public event, the first to be given to any Israeli since we signed the peace treaty with Egypt. And the event was in Semiramis, it was in all the newspapers there and here. Haaretz sent a special
correspondent
to have that. I did not believe it till the moment it happened in Semiramis Hotel, and they came very important Egyptians there, including friends of President Mubarak, who came there, which I knew. And I was talking to them. And they found somebody who speaks their language, who is very, very familiar with their culture. From his voice, his behavior, he's a man of peace. And it was such a warm and lovely atmosphere. So they come, somebody came and said, "You are not a typical Israeli. We never met an Israeli like you." I said, "How many Israelis you met?" He said, "Yes, but you are so familiar with our culture. You are one of us. You are us. You are Arab Jew."
I said,
"I am a Jew. I am a Zionist Jew."
You don't like the term Arab Jew?
I don't like it.
Okay.
I said, "It is true that I was raised in Arab culture, and part of it I admire and love, and it's part of my personal personality. But I am a Jew. I am a Zionist, I am Israeli. I will never go back to Iraq. I will never want to live in an Arab country. I fulfilled all my wishes in my country, in Israel. My mother is Hebrew. My mother tongue is Hebrew. And this is the most lovable language for me in which I can express myself there."
Incredible that you were able to take that platform and to say that.
And they applauded. Because I did not hide anything, and I said, "Although you feel that I am part of you, which is true, I am part of your culture. You are part of my identity. You are here. I know your poetry, your songs, everything that you, your history, everything is familiar for me in Cairo since my childhood. But yet, I am Israeli Zionist, and this and this." And then another question was, "What is your dream?" And I told you that Yasmin is written by a Jew, but half of the book is Palestinians. Until that moment, it was a bestseller, and it's still sold on this and that. There was not even one Arab who said, you know what, they complimented me, Arab writers, they said it was written from the stomach of an Arab.
Wow.
Yeah. From the spirit of Arab. Uh-huh. You are not a writer who wrote about Arabs. You are Arab who write about Arabs in the book. And I was criticized, of course, by Jews who said it's pro-Arabs, which is not, by the way. It's telling the, when you tell the narrative of your enemy, you automatically
become
the other category. So, then I said, "My dream is that an Arab writer, being Egyptian, Syrian, Palestinian, will write his own Yasmin, telling a love story of an Arab with a Jew, or Jew with Arab. And I know that this will be the beginning of the first steps to understand each other. If I penetrate you, no, if I internalize you, even you are my enemy, and I try to write about you from my inside, and it comes that you identify with it. It means that I'm trying to understand you deeply, and if I can, I can negotiate with you, I can live with you. We can live side by side. This is our great plus. It is not used in this country." So this is the pessimistic end of this.
Thank you, Andy. That was really good. Fabulous. You make a good argument there also for not only reading about such a story, Absolutely. About the other.
Yeah. Try to